May it please the Court, Edward Dumont, representing the taxpayer at the University of Chicago in this case. The statutory definition of wages subject to the FICA tax expressly excludes amounts paid to a 403B retirement annuity fund unless the payments are made, quote, by reason of a salary reduction agreement, close quote, within the meaning of Section 3121A5D of the Internal Revenue Code. Now, language, history, and statutory context all show that the phrase salary reduction agreement in that section refers to a voluntary choice by an employee to have the employer fund the retirement annuity with money the employee could have chosen to receive in cash. That is not the situation here, where the university's plan is funded with unilateral contributions from the university as a mandatory aspect of overall compensation.
Of course, so the statute itself doesn't say that, so we have to look to the related statutes that you've identified and the legislative history to reach that conclusion that it's only these voluntary or elective salary reduction agreements, not a mandatory one like the one at issue in this case, that would come within the exception to the exception.
Well,
that's how I understand your argument, that it's an argument to look to the surrounding statutes and related statutes as well as legislative history to get there.
Well, whatever you look at, you will get to the same place. And certainly the legislative history and the context strongly support the university's position. But we can start with the text. We should start with the text. When you, as a matter of ordinary speech, the phrase, by reason of a salary reduction agreement, indicates that we start with a salary that the employee is entitled to receive. And the employee then makes a choice, makes an agreement to reduce that salary by an amount sufficient to allow the employer to fund the annuity. That is, we submit, the common sense reading, an ordinary reading of that language.
Well, but you set it what the salary is for a particular staff person or professor or whatever, and tell them that, but you're not going to get all that because part of it's going to go to an annuity, right?
That's the way the forms read. We state a salary, and we state an amount that will be deducted from that salary as a mandatory, non-optional matter for this plan. And the IRS's entire...
Non-optional reduction.
Right. And the IRS's entire argument depends on there being a difference between saying, we'll pay you $50,000, but by the way, we're going to deduct $2,000 for this annuity plan, and you have no choice about that, and saying, we'll pay you $48,000, but by the way, it's really like $50,000 because... we're going to contribute an extra $2,000 to this plan. Their whole argument is that that difference makes all the difference in the world. And that could be true under some provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, including the provisions for qualified plans that applied, for instance, in the public employees case. It's not true under any of the provisions that apply to 403B plans. There is no provision in the code that says that that kind of formal difference in what the employer calls things makes a substantive difference as to how we treat the amounts. I mean,
for a couple of years of the plan, wasn't the amount documented with a document called it was in fact a titled salary reduction agreement?
For a couple of years, for one of the two plans at issue, only one,
and it had to be signed by the employee.
There's always a form that has to be signed by that should be signed by the employee in order to allocate contributions to particular places in the plan. It doesn't have to be signed because even if the employee doesn't sign it, the money is going to get transmitted anyway, which is one good indication that this is not a salary reduction agreement the way the code uses that phrase. But back to your question, it's true. In for some of the years, there was a form that was headed salary reduction agreement. It was only in one of the plans, and it's to be noted that in that plan, there are some contributions that are, in fact, voluntary. There are some employees who haven't reached age 25, or they haven't been there for 2 years, and under that plan, they are not required to participate until they hit those benchmarks. So for those people, it actually was an agreement, a voluntary agreement to reduce their salaries, and we agree that the taxes should have been paid on, and now have been paid, on the amounts that went into that plan under those circumstances. But there's no reason to extrapolate from the heading on that form into a holding on whether this is what Congress intended to capture 1983 when they enacted this limited exception to a rule that has been in place since 1939 that employer contributions to this kind of plan are exempt from the FICA, excluded from the FICA tax. Now, let me point out that this is not just our reading, my reading of the language as a natural reading. The IRS adopts it, too, in various contexts. And let me just point you to tab 25 of our statutory addendum. This is also quoted repeatedly in our brief. This is the IRS audit guidelines for Section 403B plans. It's just one of many, many such lines. But I'm looking at page SA-74. And in those guidelines, it says, in a salary reduction 403B plan, an employer gives participants a choice between receiving an amount in cash or having the employer contribute that amount to the 403B plan. Now, that's exactly our position about what this language means. And at an absolute minimum, what it shows is that the language can be interpreted that way. And so, if nothing else, we need to turn to the history and the context of the provision. As to history, we have a couple of things. The first is Revenue Ruling 65208. Now, the IRS concedes that that revenue ruling is the source of this salary reduction agreement language in 1983, and that what Congress intended to do was adopt or codify that ruling. That ruling is reprinted at tab 21 of our materials. And just to walk through it for a second, on page SA-64, what we have here in laying out the facts of that ruling, and all revenue rulings are limited and controlled by their facts. That's in the regulations. Here we have an employee entering into an agreement with the organization to take a reduction in salary for the purpose of providing funds for the purpose of the annuity. And it goes on to tell us two important things right after that. One, the agreement applies only to amounts that are earned after the employee enters into the agreement. Well, in some sense, that's self-evident. But it also indicates that we're talking about people who are in the stream of employment. They've already been hired, and the agreement intervenes. We're not talking about initiation of employment agreements. And the next sentence says, the employee is not permitted to make more than one such agreement during any one taxable year. So we are talking about voluntary agreements that can be renewed yearly. We are not talking about the decision to go to work at the university, which is what the IRS would rely on here. And on the following page, the entire ruling, the IRS holds that these amounts are subject to FICA tax, and their whole distinction of the prior law turns on the distinction between the employer using its own funds, quote unquote, for the annuity, or the employee taking a voluntary reduction in salary to provide the necessary funds. And we submit that a fair facial reading of that ruling strongly supports exactly our position, which is we're talking about stream of employment agreements where the employee makes a voluntary choice. The employee has already earned the right to receive that money in cash. Therefore, it's the employee's funds, not the employer's funds anymore. And the employee makes the choice to reduce the salary he or she could otherwise receive and divert that to the annuity. That's what that revenue ruling is about, and that's what Congress intended to adopt in 1983. Now, we also know that from the 1983 committee reports themselves, and we've discussed them at length in our briefs, but let me just focus on one key provision. This is at tab 11 in our materials. It's also quoted at page 25 of our brief. It's from the House report. There's similar language in the Senate report. I'm looking at page SA-20. Here's the key sentence. This is the sentence in which the drafters tell us why they were enacting this special language in 1983. Otherwise, without the salary reduction agreement language, otherwise, individuals could, in effect, individually direct the equivalent of cash compensation for their own purposes in order to avoid FICA taxes. And this would make the system partially elective and would undermine the FICA tax base. Making the system partially elective at the individual employee level, that's what Congress was concerned about. And that is completely consistent with the university's approach here, which is that a salary reduction agreement is an employee who has the choice to take cash instead making the choice to take those funds and divert them to the annuity. It is not at all consistent. That rationale is not at all consistent with the IRS's position in this case. Now, I'd like to turn for a moment to statutory context. Judge Sykes mentioned that we rely on the complex of statutes that relate to 403B plans. That's exactly right. We do. And when you look at that complex of provisions, you'll see that in every place, and it occurs repeatedly, but in every place where a salary reduction agreement or a similar phrase is used, It refers to what we are talking about. It refers to an individual employee election, just like a 401k election or a TSP election. That's the kind of individual cash or deferred election that Congress was talking about. We've talked about a number of provisions. Let me just focus on one, the most important perhaps. It's a tab 4 of our materials. It's 402G3, the income tax provision. Now, in 1986, Congress, in continuing its process of assimilating all of these cash or deferred programs and making the rules consistent across all of them, turns and it enacts a uniform aggregate limit on the deferrals under this kind of cash or deferred plan. It includes 403B plans in that list, and in defining elective deferral, this is what it says about 403B plans. Any employer contribution to purchase an annuity contract under 403B under a salary reduction agreement within the meaning of Section 3121A5D. So we have here in enacted statutory language, this is not legislative history, this is enacted statutory language from 1986 directing us to interpret the 3121A5D language as referring to elective deferrals under voluntary plans. And we submit there couldn't be a clearer, aside from having it in 3125A5D itself, 3121A5D itself, there couldn't be a clearer indication of congressional intent here. And just to button that up, I mean, the one other piece of legislative history I will repeat there is the conference report on that legislation says the following. If an employee is required to contribute a fixed percentage of compensation to a tax-sheltered annuity, it's a 403B annuity, as a condition of employment, the contributions are not treated as elective deferrals. Now, the IRS has suggested a way that maybe they can explain about how that language and that rule in 402G3 can be reconciled with their position about 3121, but we submit that it cannot.
That was a conference report, though, right?
That was a conference report. That's right. But the enacted statutory language, again, to go back to that, the enacted statutory language is not something where we're drawing the analogy to 3121A5D. It's where Congress expressly says in the statutory enactment itself that we're using the same meaning as in 3121A5D. And they're doing that, and they're doing it in a section that deals with elective deferrals under just this kind of plan, 401 kind of plan, 401K kind of plan.
If we adopt your interpretation of the statute, we would be creating a circuit split with the Tenth Circuit, or do you see a way of distinguishing that Tenth Circuit case?
I think it's absolutely distinguishable. There's no reason at all to think of that as creating a conflict, and here's why. What the Tenth Circuit did in the public employees case was to deal with a different provision of 3121. It's 3121V as opposed to D, and it is in the very specific context of state and local government pickup plans. They're plans under really materially different provisions of the code that apply to those plans, starting with the one I mentioned before, which is as to those plans, there actually is in the code in Section 414H. There is a specific direction that the way you decide whether something is an employer or an employee contribution is just by looking at the words the employer uses. That's in the code for that kind of plan. It is not in the code for this kind of plan. Now, public employees looks at this language that Congress enacted in 3121V1B, and it says, what are we going to do with this? Let me just quote one sentence from their opinion. It's at the bottom of page 1165 and 153F3. Our understanding of salary reduction agreement in Section 3121V1B is dictated by our understanding of the term pickup as that term is used in Section 414H2. So first of all, that sentence tells you that this has nothing to do with a holding that salary reduction agreement as three words has some plain language meaning that compels a result in favor of the IRS in this case. That's point one. Point two is what they are doing is looking, quite sensibly, to how the FICA provision at issue in that case interacts with the income tax provisions at issue in that case, which is to say, for 414H2, the provisions that deal with the qualified pickup plans, state and local pickup plans, doing exactly the same thing in this case leads to the opposite result, which is here you need to look at the provisions in the code that deal with 403B plans. That's the kind of plan that we have here. And when you look at those provisions, for all the reasons we've suggested, you're going to find is that absolutely consistently throughout those provisions, this term salary reduction agreement refers to voluntary cash or deferred elections where the employee has the choice. Now, you cannot decide this case without either creating some discrepancy between 3121A1D and V1B, or creating an anomaly, a discontinuity in the provisions that govern 403B plans. You have to do one or the other. Now, we submit that although the maxim that you should interpret the same words in the same section of a statute is a perfectly good maxim, what it means is you interpret the same words in the same way in provisions that relate to each other as a substantive matter. And here, the way that applies is that you interpret it consistently throughout the provisions that apply to 403B. And with respect, V1B and the state pickup plan provisions have nothing to do with the kinds of plans that are issued here. And there's no reason for any consistency there. And there's absolutely no conflict that would be created with the Shalala case if the court resolves this case in favor of the university. Okay. Court, please, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Kahn. Mr. Green.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kenneth Green on behalf of the United States. As the court pointed out, this plain statutory language does not contain the voluntary or elective language that the taxpayer would seek. The taxpayer, in fact, crafts his argument around what he calls the context of the provision. What the government's position here would be with respect to the context of the provision is that within 1 year, the very same Congress, very same senators and House of Representative members, enacted the same language in two provisions of subsections of the same statute. In 1983, both 3121A5D and 3121V1B were enacted in the 1983 Act. 3121A5D included the salary reduction agreement language. 3121V1B did not. However, in the very next year, that same Congress, in a technical correction, included that very same language. The government submits that it's simply inconceivable that Congress would intend, in that situation, in that context, to have the very same language mean such different things. And indeed, in the public employees case, the court held that the individuals, when they agreed to the employment or agreed to continue employment, were in fact agreeing, and so there was a salary reduction agreement. And we believe, the government believes, that the same necessarily holds true in the 3121A5D context. The taxpayer here, University of Chicago, looks to the legislative history and quote selectively from that legislative history. And indeed, at times, they do talk about elective or voluntary. They don't ever say, however, that only elective or voluntary arrangements are salary reduction agreements. However, what they do say is that one of the primary concerns of the 1983 as well as the 1984 amendments was the financial soundness of the Social Security system. They stress the coverage, the breadth of coverage of the Social Security system, and explicitly state that only explicit exclusions from that should be provided for. Again, no report says that only mandatory arrangements are elective. The Senate report says that they're codifying the revenue ruling 65-208, but they also say it's without any implication as to whether a particular payment is made via a salary reduction agreement. And then in the conference report in the very next year with the technical correction, which puts in the technical correction to 3121V1B, they also explicitly state that the language salary reduction agreement is not limited to elective arrangements. So the legislative history simply does not establish what the University of Chicago tries to establish. And again, I think it's the wrong context. The correct context is what that Congress actually did within, the same Congress actually did within 1 year of each other. They speak of it being in different contexts, different statutes, and that is a distinction. Indeed, they are different statutes. However, the dispositive context of both statutes are the same. They both use the phrase salary reduction agreement to narrow the exclusion from Social Security tax. The University of Chicago has also complained that the government's position elevates form over substance. They say that it makes no difference whether there is a reduction from a stated salary or whether you just add a contribution on top of a lower salary, but that simply is not correct. First of all, the benefits that a employee earns is based upon his stated Social Security salary. The higher the salary, until a specific limit, the higher the benefits he's going to earn. So it does affect the benefits he's going to earn. It also...
If I could get you back to the conference report. I mean, I realize this language is all over the place, but it says if an employee is required to contribute a fixed percentage of compensation to a tax shelter annuity as a condition of employment, the contributions are not treated as elective deferrals. Is that... I mean, what does that mean? That's from the
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
The 1986 conference report, new 403B, elective deferral. If an employee is required to contribute a fixed percentage of compensation to a tax-sheltered annuity as a condition of employment, the contributions are not treated as elective deferrals.
Well, first of all, there's no need to even... speak to that if salary reduction agreements didn't include mandatory contributions in the first instance. But the key point here is that deals with Section 402.3b. 403B, I'm sorry. Well, okay. And that is an income tax provision in the very same act that enacted 3121A5D and 3121V1B, Congress also enacted the provision overruling the Rowan decision, which said that those two, the income tax and the FICA tax, had to be interpreted consistently. And indeed, they don't have to be. It's well established now that they don't have to be interpreted consistently. So the rules for the income tax provisions simply don't necessarily control the rules for the FICA tax provisions. The FICA tax provisions are generally construed much broader, consistent with the idea of coverage and with the whole underlying purpose of the 83 Acts, which was to ensure the financial and the fiscal stability of the Social Security system. And indeed, that was the next point of my substance argument, which was that the employer's contribution to the Social Security system is based on that same stated salary. And the higher the stated salary, the higher the employer's contribution to the Social Security system. Not only that, but the higher the stated salary, the higher the employer's contribution to the 403B benefit plan that the employee participates in, because under the plans here, the employer contributes a percentage of the stated salary of the employee. The employer is also unable to tout a higher salary. But even if there was no substance, no difference between the two sorts of arrangements, a salary supplement and a salary reduction, this court in Howell made it perfectly clear that in the employment relationship, the form that the employer picks controls. The employer gets to pick which way he's going to call it, whether it's going to be a salary reduction, whether it's going to be a salary supplement, and he has to live with that choice. The taxpayer has also looked to the Internal Revenue Manual to attempt to support its position. But again, the Internal Revenue Manual speaks to 402 and 403 provisions, not the Social Security provisions. The Internal Revenue Manual does not attempt to define what a salary reduction agreement is, does not state it is only elective. Indeed, a provision of it, 4.72.13.1.1.2 sub 7, says that salary reduction agreements themselves are generally subject to Social Security. And lastly, the Internal Revenue Manual is by no means precedential. It's simply guidance for the auditing for income tax purposes of the plans. The taxpayer, although he did not speak of it on his opening argument, has also suggested that he is not subject to liability for the employee portion of the withholding under the Central Illinois Deputy Tax Collector defense. However, the government believes that the plain language of the statute, the revenue ruling, and public employees all put him on notice that indeed he did have a withholding obligation, particularly when you add that to the well-known broad construction that inclusion in Social Security calls for and the narrow construction of exemptions. In fact, his own plan, as the court pointed out, some of the agreements were called salary reduction agreements, and his the forms themselves often talked in terms of the reducing of salary. And at the least, a technical advice memorandum issued to one of the affiliates of taxpayer in August of 2002 specifically said that mandatory contributions were subject to the Social Security tax. If the court has no further questions, I will rest on my brief.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Dumont, how much time does Mr. Dumont have? 4 minutes, Mr. Dumont.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few brief points. First of all, the IRS tries to give substance to its position here by maintaining that benefits turn on this distinction. Well, the benefits turn on how the university states the salary, the stated salary. That is simply not correct. We pointed out in our reply brief, it's true that the benefits provisions and the tax provisions are parallel because they use exactly the same language. The key is wages, not stated salary, and the definition of wages for the two purposes is precisely the same. It uses the same broad exclusion for employer contributions with the narrow exemption for salary reduction agreement contributions. So there is that can't help the IRS here in terms of giving substance to their point. Second, counsel relies on the 1984 legislative history for V1B, but first of all, for all the reasons we suggested, that's not a good parallel to this provision. And second, more important, in 1986, as Your Honor pointed out, Congress comes along. This is after 1984. It enacts the statutory language in 402G3, which specifically cross-references the A1D language. And it says in the legislative history there, could not be plainer, that mandatory condition of employment agreements are not elective deferrals, and by direct extension, they're also not salary reduction agreements in the original provision. Third, counsel cited the Howell case for the proposition that whatever the employer says dictates. I invite the court to look back at the Howell case. Howell bases that on the language in 414H1, which does apply to qualified plans like the plans at issue in Howell and in Chalala, or the public employees case, unlike this plan. That section refers to 403A plans. This is a 403B plan. That language is not at all apposite here. Fourth, Congress well, counsel appeals to the principle that there should be broad coverage for FICA provisions because we need to fund the Social Security system. That's an unobjectionable general proposition, but what we have here is an exclusion, an express exclusion for employer contributions to this sort of plan, which has been in place since 1939, a very broad exclusion. We have a narrow exception added in 1983, and the question here is the scope of that precise exception. It's not. This does not turn on some general maxim about raising revenue. And the final point I would turn to is counsel mentioned the penalties question. For all the reasons we've stated, we think at a very minimum, the university's position here is utterly reasonable, and it is completely without foundation for the IRS either to seek the withholding liability for the employer, let alone to seek penalties for failure to deposit or failure to pay. If we look at what was on the public record at the time the taxpayer made its decisions here, we had the 1939 Act with its broad exclusion. We had the regulations under that Act, some of which have still not been repealed and which in their terms directly cover, these are in footnote 13 of our brief, directly cover this sort of payment and say that it is excluded. We had Revenue Ruling 65-208. We had the 1983 legislative history. We had the 1986 Act and its specific statutory cross-reference. And we have the IRS audit guidelines. And on their side, they have the Shalala case, which is completely inapposite, and the technical advice memorandum, which has no standing as public authority. It's the opinion of some lawyers in the IRS counsel's office. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dumont. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.